Chapter 6. Bacterial Pathogenesis. Most people, when they consider bacteria, identify them as a cause of disease. It is relevant to ask why bacteria became pathogenic to man. The reason is straightforward: in order to provide them with a source of nutrition and as a means of spread. Actually, very virulent bacteria, which cause death quickly, are often not in the optimum situation for their spread. Although not toxic itself, the soil bacterium Clostridium botulinum produces toxins, for example, if it is present in tinned food that has been insufficiently sterilised. In the anaerobic conditions in the tin, the toxins are produced. They are amongst the deadliest known. Ingestion of these botulinum neurotoxins gives an almost immediate reaction, as there is reduced acetylcholine release, which blocks the electrical transmission to the nerves controlling the muscles. The paralysis caused soon affects breathing, leading to death. The incapacity of the patient drastically reduces the ability of the organism to spread, and the bacteria remain trapped in the dying patient. A similar situation is found with bubonic plague, caused by Yersinia pestis. Unless the bacterium spreads to the respiratory tract and becomes airborne, which is rare, then the bacterium dies with the patient. So hyperpathogenic is not necessarily beneficial. Stages of pathogenesis. It is likely that bacteria were not originally pathogenic, and that they have developed this trait through evolutionary changes. Bacteria must have first infected invertebrates, and then eventually through mammals, and on to us. The transmission of an infectious organism from animals to cause disease in humans is known as zoonosis, and it is considered that most bacterial infections started this way, though some bacteria may now have evolved further so that they infect only man. The successful invading pathogenic bacteria have to establish themselves at the optimum site for nutrition and subsequent release from their host. They are equipped with molecules known as virulence factors, which allow them to achieve this, and these broadly fall into four groups: adhesins, aggressins, impedins, and invasins. The names are almost self-explanatory. The adhesins allow the bacteria to bind preferentially at specific positions to ensure that the bacteria are optimally placed. An example of these are the fimbriae that position bacteria responsible for diarrhea high in the gastrointestinal tract, away from the normal commensal bacteria of the lower bowel, giving them an advantage as they have earlier access to the nutrients passing down the gut. The aggressins are usually enzymes that have a localised effect, often producing a barrier between the bacteria and the host defences. The common pathogen Staphylococcus aureus produces coagulase, converting fibrin from fibrinogen and effectively placing the invading bacteria within a clot, preventing access to the host defences. Impedins act against the individual defence systems themselves. They include the ability to produce a protective capsule, such as that which surrounds Streptococcus pneumoniae, without which it cannot shield itself from the defences in the lungs. They even include molecules that can degrade antibodies, such as the two cysteine proteinases in Streptococcus pyogenes. The integrity of the antibody molecule is held together by cysteine-cysteine disulfide bonds, which these enzymes destroy. Invasins allow the bacteria to move within the host once the initial infection has been established. E. coli O157H7 is a pathogen that differs from the commensal E. coli in that it is able to invade the host by migrating out of the gastrointestinal tract into the bloodstream. Whatever the host, in the first instance, the bacterium has to enter. In humans, there are many entry points. The most obvious are through ingestion in the gastrointestinal tract, through inhalation in the respiratory tract, and via contact with the skin. The skin is a natural barrier to bacteria and protects against infection. However, if it is broken through either a small insect bite or a larger wound, bacterial invasion can soon follow. There are other routes as well, such as through the eyes, the sexual organs, and the nose. Some infections are caused by commensal bacteria already within the body, that have, for some reason such as an underlying disease, been able to grow and spread. This is usually termed an opportunistic infection. Once inside, the bacterium has to establish itself quickly. Many bacteria just start growing in the epithelial cells close to the point of entry. This is characterized by the boils caused by Staphylococcus aureus on the skin, or the establishment of gonorrhea by Neisseria gonorrhoeae on the mucous membranes of the sexual organs. In the lungs and intestine, there are macrophages, which are non-specific phagocytic cells of the host immune system that migrate quickly to the incoming bacteria, engulf and destroy them. This is usually the first line of host defence. After engulfing the bacteria, the macrophages return to the lymph nodes with the key surface structures of the invading pathogen, thus stimulating acquired specific immunity against future invasion. The triggering of macrophages stimulates other immune responses. Some bacteria can cross the epithelial cells to cause systemic infection. Mycobacterium tuberculosis crosses the epithelium in the lungs to cause pulmonary tuberculosis. Salmonella enterica cerevar typhi crosses the epithelial of the intestinal tract as a precursor to causing typhoid. So the bacteria are able to leave the localized environment at the entry point and become systemic, entering the bloodstream or the lymphatic system. When some bacteria pass through the epithelium, they are held up by the basement membrane, which can act as a barrier in itself. As the bacteria reach this point, other body defences start. Complement is a compound within the blood and other bodily fluids that kills bacteria on contact, but this is often circumnavigated. However, the migration of bacteria identifies their presence, and the host produces chemotaxins and cytokines. These identify the position of the pathogen, and the local phagocytes migrate towards them, following the track of the chemotaxins. The defence system also releases opsonins, which bind to the invaders and mark them for the phagocytes, greatly increasing the chances of recognition and destruction. It used to be thought that the trigger for this response was the lipopolysaccharide at the cell surface, but more recently it has been found that proteins, carbohydrates and lipids can all stimulate cytokines in mammalian cells. These are collectively known as modulins. This is the start of the inflammatory response, the result of which gives us the feeling of burning at the site of infection. Indeed, much of the pain associated with infection is often due not to the invading bacterium, but rather to our body's response to it. Successful bacterial infection, however, has to overcome the body's defences, and many bacteria have the ability to do this. For example, streptococci produce streptolysins, which attack membranes and release the contents of the host cell, whether this is a red blood cell or a phagocytic defence cell. And the beta toxin of Clostridium perfringens causes the necrotizing of endothelial cells that make them leaky and destroys their integrity. The main role of these bacterial compounds is to interfere with or annihilate the host defence system, and thus they often influence the activity of cytokines, macrophages, and neutrophils, and may cause localized host cell death or apoptosis, the net effect of which is to prevent the host defences reaching the invading bacteria. As the infection proceeds, the bacteria will usually replicate, and this often generates a range of responses from the immune system. The body temperature may increase to slow bacterial growth, and as long as it does not go too high, this is a potent method of control. This is often coupled with a feeling of malaise. If the body cannot cope at this stage, either a chronic disease establishes itself, or the infection may even lead to death. Usually, though, the transport of the key bacterial components by the macrophages to the lymph nodes initiates the formation, within a couple of weeks, of antibodies, which specifically seek out the individual bacteria that caused the infection. It would explain why bronchitis, often caused by Haemophilus influenzae, takes about 3 weeks to resolve, if not treated quickly with antibiotics. This is known as acquired immunity, and is the basis of vaccination. Once the bacteria have been able to multiply, they need to escape to infect other hosts. Death of the host often inhibits this release of bacteria, so death itself is not usually directed by the bacteria. More often, it is due to tissue damage from the host defences. Escape is important, and bacteria produce many mechanisms to achieve this. The most obvious are the toxins. The enterotoxin of Staphylococcus aureus is released when the organism is growing, often on food outside the body. When ingested, it elicits violent vomiting, thus spreading the bacteria to the environment. Similarly, the diarrhea-causing bacteria often produce a toxin that induces rapid and frequent bowel movements to release the bacteria back to the environment. The most extreme example is Vibrio cholerae, which causes such severe diarrhea that this alone can cause death through rapid dehydration if untreated. It also demonstrates how we have controlled infections without the use of antibiotics, but rather through improved hygiene. In developed countries, human waste is collected and treated, so the route for the spread of bacteria such as Vibrio cholerae has been broken. The cough induced by Mycobacterium tuberculosis in TB is the mechanism to promote its spread. However, changes in lifestyle in the developed world have considerably reduced the risk of infection, because individual dwellings are now less crowded and fewer people share the same room. Diphtheria, caused by Corynebacterium diphtheriae, was often spread via aerosol droplets to many members of the same family, especially if they slept in the same room. The sexually transmitted bacteria are released in the same manner as they were acquired, two mucous membranes coming into close contact, one of which was infected. Toxins. Many of the symptoms that we associate with bacterial infection actually result from the toxins bacteria excrete. Indeed, the symptoms may develop even if there are no live bacteria, provided the toxin has been released. A simple initial demarcation is to classify them as endotoxins or exotoxins. Endotoxins are usually part of the bacterial cell, often found on the surface. They are not released until the bacteria are destroyed by the immune system. When released, endotoxins can induce inflammation, but can also lead to septic shock if there are too many endotoxins in the blood. Many endotoxins are thought to derive from the lipopolysaccharides that make up the cell surface. Although antibodies are effective against lipopolysaccharides, they are more active against intact molecules. The endotoxins are usually smaller components. They are responsible for increases in body temperature and the lowering of blood pressure. The bacterium Neisseria meningitidis, the cause of rapid onset of and severe meningitis in young adults, has a waxy coat that contains an endotoxin. It is the level of endotoxin that makes this organism so lethal. It is often more than 100-fold greater than other bacterial types. Although better known for invading the meninges, it is particularly deadly if it can produce sepsis in the blood. The endotoxin can rupture blood vessels, leading to severe hemorrhaging. The basic treatment for Neisseria meningitidis infection is aggressive antibiotic therapy. However, one of the products of antibiotic treatment is that the bacterial cell is broken up, and this releases endotoxin. So certain antibiotics may actually exacerbate the clinical manifestation of an infection rather than resolve it if an endotoxin is present. Exotoxins are molecules that are released from live bacterial cells. They are usually the component that causes the clinical manifestation of diseases, and it is not always necessary for the bacterium to be present. The enterotoxin of Staphylococcus aureus and the botulinum toxin of Clostridium botulinum, described previously, are clear examples. The neurotoxic properties of botulinum toxin A have been put to cosmetic and medical use. Botox has been used to remove wrinkles because it causes flaccid paralysis of local muscles, thus removing wrinkles that arise from muscle contraction. Its effect on wrinkles is not permanent and wears off after a few months. Less well publicised is its medical use, where it was first used to treat eye disorders such as continuous blinking or eyes that were not properly aligned with each other, such as cross-eyed. It worked in the same way by relaxing the muscles. However, its use has become far more extensive, for example, to control sweating, migraines and incontinence, amongst many other conditions. It is perhaps surprising that such a powerful poison can be put to so many different uses. With its frequent cosmetic use, it is easy to forget how deadly botulinum toxin can actually be. 1 gram is thought to be sufficient to kill 1 million people. Other exotoxins are less beneficial and can be as deadly. Bacillus anthracis produces a 3-protein exotoxin. One component, called protective antigen, binds the host cell, and there are 2 enzymes known as edema factor and lethal factor. These 3 proteins individually have little effect, but together they form a complex. The protective antigen transports the 2 enzymes into the cell. Once inside, the edema factor increases the level of cyclic adenosine monophosphate, CAMP, which controls the water balance inside the cell. Increasing the level of CAMP increases water retention, hence the edema, and this lessens the effect of the host defense macrophages. The lethal factor destroys the proteins of the cell, leading to cell death. This is an extremely effective mechanism, and patients who contract an anthrax infection soon become very ill. Anthrax can be contracted through inhalation or direct contact. Although anthrax is relatively rare, through the skin is currently the most common method to contract the infection, and if the bacterium invades by this method, it is rarely fatal. Gastrointestinal infection from infected food is very rare and can cause severe diarrhea. Severe anthrax infection usually results from inhaling spores of the bacteria into the lungs, and its mortality rate is greater than 90%, with death occurring within 2 days after the onset of symptoms. About 10,000 inhaled spores are sufficient to cause death. Traditionally, those who worked with animals, particularly their hides, were vulnerable to infection. It was called wool sorter's disease for this reason. The bacterium relies on the death of the host to spread further. In the dead carcass, it forms spores, which then may become airborne or ingested by other animals. One of the deadliest exotoxins known is produced by Clostridium tetani, the organism that causes tetanus. When the organism enters damaged tissue, it produces a neurotoxin which is inactive while still inside the living bacterium and is not released until the bacterium dies. Once activated by proteases, the toxin amplifies the signals from nerves to the muscles, and this can give the characteristic spasms associated with tetanus. Although often identified in the head, hence the name lockjaw, actually muscles all over the body are affected, including those for breathing. Death often follows, even with the use of artificial respiration. In unvaccinated and untreated patients, death is almost inevitable. The bacterium that has had the greatest impact on the European population over the last 2 millennia is Yersinia pestis, the cause of plague. Though little was known about it at the time, it is thought to have been responsible for reducing the British population from 4 to 1 million during the first or Justinian pandemic in the middle of the 6th century. It was thought that initial transmission to humans is from a bite from the infected fleas of rats. The bacterium blocks the proventriculus of the flea, effectively causing a state of starvation in the flea, which becomes desperate to feed. On finding a victim, the flea tries to feed from the blood, but vomits the content of its stomach into the bite wound, and thus into the victim's bloodstream. Once inside the new host, the bacteria accumulate in the lymph nodes, and they multiply extraordinarily quickly, causing the lymph nodes to swell considerably. These are known as buboes, and are the distinctive symptom of infection. The bacterium releases a toxin complex, TC, and virulence factors, which inhibit the phagocytes, preventing the neutrophils accumulating, promoting cell apoptosis, death, and the breakdown of clots, releasing the bacteria into the bloodstream. If the bacteria get into the lungs before death, they can multiply quickly, as they will prevent the body's defences from working here also. Bubonic plague could be spread by other biting human parasites, such as lice, but with good hygiene it is likely to be a self-limiting disease. On the other hand, if the bacteria proliferate in the lungs, then it becomes pneumonic, producing fever and a productive cough with bloody or watery sputum. These form drops, which may be inhaled by those in close face-to-face contact with the patient. This form of plague is very virulent and was probably responsible for the death of a third of the English population in the epidemic of 1348-49, known as the Black Death. Virulence factors encoded by foreign DNA. The ability to be virulent, particularly in humans, is likely to be a later development in the evolution of bacteria and results from their adaptation to this new environment. It takes a long time for bacteria to evolve individual genes, and this can be achieved much more quickly on DNA that is not part of the bacterial chromosome. The location of virulence genes on extrachromosomal DNA ensures first that if mutations occur in the evolution of the genes, they are not lethal to the bacterium, as they might be if they occurred in the bacterium's own DNA. And second, as these pieces of DNA are mobile, genes that have evolved in one bacterium can be passed easily to others. Some genes known to cause virulence are located on bacteriophages, and without these genes the bacteria would not cause an infection. These bacteriophages have, at some time in the past, integrated themselves into the bacterium's DNA. They may remain dormant, known as a prophage, and eventually be induced to release new bacteriophages. On the other hand, the bacterium may go through what is known as lysogenic conversion, whereby the genes in the prophage start to express, conferring novel traits on the bacterial cell. The diphtheria toxin produced by Corynebacterium diphtheriae, and primarily responsible for the disease, is located on such a lysogenic bacteriophage. Similarly, the toxins responsible for cholera produced by Vibrio cholerae, botulism produced by Clostridium botulinum, and scarlet fever produced by Streptococcus pyogenes are all derived from lysogenic bacteriophages. Plasmids and pathogenicity. Plasmids, another form of extrachromosomal DNA found in bacteria, are also known to encode virulence factors, and this is common in some species. The virulence of non-typhoid Salmonella species is often encoded on plasmids. In particular, the SPV gene of Salmonella typhimurium, which allows the pathogen to invade the liver and spleen, is located on a transferable plasmid. The product of this gene considerably reduces the number of bacteria required to cause a severe infection. Plasmids in E. coli can carry genes that allow the bacteria to colonize the small intestine, where bacterial numbers are usually very low. This allows the bacteria to have earlier access to the nutrients passing down the gastrointestinal tract, removing the need to compete with the bacteria of the large intestine. The gene responsible for the attachment produces fimbriae, which allow the bacteria to attach to enterocyte cells. Alone, this attachment does not cause severe symptoms, but it is usually accompanied by the presence of two plasmid-encoded enterotoxins, heat-stable, ST, and heat-labile, LT, toxins. Both toxins stimulate loss of electrolytes and water excretion from the human enterocytes, hence the symptoms of diarrhea. Both the attachment fimbriae and the toxins are required for maximum effect. These E. coli are known as enterotoxigenic, or ETECs, and they are the common cause of traveller's diarrhea, notably because visitors do not have the antibodies to these local bacteria. These bacteria are not invasive, and the symptoms are usually self-limiting as long as the patient remains well hydrated. The plasmid-encoded fimbriae in uropathic E. coli, UPEC, operate in a similar manner, with the adhesion allowing the formation of a microcolony in the urethra or the bladder. In this case, it is purely the position of the colonization that is important, and no toxins are involved. They produce the classic symptoms of a urinary tract infection. Often self-limiting and usually easily treatable with antibiotics, the infection can become more severe if the bacteria are able to travel up into the kidneys, where the establishment of an infection can cause pyelonephritis. Enteroaggregative E. coli, EAEC, also produces watery diarrhea like ETECs. A separate plasmid produces aggregative adhesion fimbriae that aggregate human cells, stacking them like bricks. The bacteria also produce a hemolysin and a stable toxin, but the pathogenic mechanisms are less well understood. Infections caused by EAECs, currently far less common than those caused by ETECs, are increasing, particularly in North America. The chromosome and pathogenicity. The E. coli that make the media headlines are usually enteropathogenic, EPEC, or enterohemorrhagic, EHEC, E. coli. These bacteria do not use fimbriae for attachment. Instead, the bacteria come into close proximity with the epithelial cells of the gut and form a characteristic attachment to these cells and localized destruction, effacing, of the microvilli. The attaching and effacing genes are located in the bacterial chromosome in an area known as the locus of enterocyte effacement, or LEE region. The EAE gene in this region encodes intimin, an adhesin similar to one responsible for cellular invasion in Yersinia pestis. This forms the close attachment. The TIR protein, encoded by the TIR gene in the LEE region, is transported to the human cell where it acts as a receptor for intimin. In other words, the bacterium not only produces the means by which the bacterium binds to the human cell, but also exports the mechanism by which the human cell accepts this binding. EHECs cause more severe infections than EPECs, as they produce a phage-encoded cytotoxin, similar to that found in Shigella, known as verotoxin. This toxin produces bloody diarrhea and can directly attack the kidney cells. Platelet numbers are severely reduced by clotting, thrombocytopenia, leading to hemolytic anemia, known as hemolytic uremic syndrome, HUS. The most infamous EHEC strain, E. coli O157H7, has been responsible for a number of outbreaks and many deaths, but there are other strains as well, including strains O145 and O104. Strain O145H4 was responsible for the major outbreak in Germany in 2011. Pathogenicity islands. The LEE region of these pathogenic E. coli is located on the bacterial chromosome, but the region itself is known as a pathogenicity island, PI. PIs can contain clusters of virulence genes, which can include adherence genes, toxins, invasins, and so on. They are called islands because they can usually be defined as DNA that is distinct from the rest of the bacterial chromosome, and has thus been imported into the bacterium by some form of gene transfer, perhaps originally on plasmids or phages, which may have long since been lost. The telltale signs, however, are usually present. The region is usually flanked by direct repeated sequences of DNA. The sequences at either end are identical, and they are associated with transposase and integrase genes, which would promote movement between chromosome and mobile DNA. They are often closely associated with transfer RNA genes. The composition of their DNA is different from the rest of the bacterial chromosome, indicating that their origins are different. The movement of discrete blocks of DNA, carrying virulence genes from one bacterium to another, means that the evolutionary solution that once caused one strain of bacteria to develop these genes may be passed on directly to other strains, without them having to be relearned. Besides E. coli, PIs are found in Salmonella enterica, Helicobacter pylori, Shigella species, Yersinia pestis, and Vibrio cholerae. The similarity of the attachment and effacing genes in Helicobacter, the invasive nature of Salmonella and Yersinia, and toxins in Shigella and Vibrio with those found in various pathogenic strains of E. coli suggest that although they are not identical, they probably had a common origin. In these cases, the transfer of the virulence genes has accelerated the ability of non-pathogenic species to become pathogenic. Many of these strains of bacteria are pathogenic only to humans, and there has been insufficient time since the emergence of man for these pathogenicity mechanisms to have evolved independently. Flesh-eating bacteria. Until 30 years ago, most people had not heard of flesh-eating bacteria, or rather necrotizing fasciitis. It is an extremely rare infection in previously healthy individuals, but rather more common in patients with some other underlying disease or a medical procedure that has compromised the immune system. The most typical cause is Streptococcus pyogenes, but only very rare specialized strains with specific virulence determinants. The bacterium does not eat, but rather causes a rapid infection of the skin and particularly spreading through the subcutaneous layers. Infection starts at a point of injury, which may be severe, such as an operation incision, or even undetected, which allows the bacterium access. Inflammation occurs if the infection is near the surface, and this may soon turn to necrosis or death of the tissue. Early and aggressive intravenous antibiotic therapy can limit the damage of the infection, though the dead tissue has to be removed. However, most doctors have never seen a case of necrotizing fasciitis and may not recognize it, particularly if the initial infection is deep. It is extremely serious if untreated and will often lead to death. Vector-borne diseases. These are normally associated with viruses and parasites. The devastating example in the past has been plague, but nowadays the tick-borne bacterium from the genus Borrelia causes more medical problems. It was first identified in the town of Lyme, Connecticut, in 1975, where the causative bacterium was Borrelia burgdorferi. The tick often ingests the bacterium after biting deer, so the disease is often found in areas frequented by deer. If the tick subsequently bites another animal, it vomits the bacterium into the bloodstream. If not treated early with antibiotics, the eventual symptoms can become disabling and lead to arthritis and paraplegia. It has spread to areas of the United Kingdom and Europe where there are deer. In this case, the causative bacteria are different species, Borrelia afzelii and Borrelia garinii. Tooth decay and gum disease. We associate bacteria with identifiable infections of the body, but every day we take precautions to limit the damage caused by the bacteria in our mouth. We brush our teeth to prevent the tooth decay, dental caries, and gum diseases, periodontal disease, caused by the bacteria in our mouths. There are many different species of oral bacteria, but the most damaging are often those of the Streptococcus genus. Examination of skulls from people who had lived up to the 16th century shows a relatively low incidence of damage due to tooth decay. Then the major sweetener had been honey, which contains antibiotic properties that would prevent its use as a nutrition source for oral bacteria. The colonization of the West Indies and the importation of sugar, sucrose, particularly as it became available as an everyday commodity, soon led to widespread and serious tooth decay. Sucrose provides a nutrition source for the bacteria, which they ferment. The result of this fermentation, which is similar to what we have seen in the production of yogurt, is the production of acid. It is this acid that destroys the enamel of the tooth and causes cavities. Tooth decay began to be controlled first by the introduction of bristle toothbrushes by William Addis in the early 19th century, which removed the bacterial biofilm. Tooth decay was still a serious problem by the middle of the 20th century. It had been known that fluoride prevented tooth decay by replacing hydroxide ions in the tooth enamel, making it much more resistant to acid attack. Initially, there was controversy about the use of fluoride, but these fears were allayed when the remarkable effects of fluoride in preventing cavities were recognized and the risks were deemed to be small. Now fluoride is regularly added to both toothpaste and water supplies, with a consequent reduction in tooth decay. Pandemics. It is probably not appreciated that bacterial infections cause considerably more deaths than those caused by viruses, not least for the reason that the actual cause of death associated with a virus infection is often manifested by a secondary infection caused by a bacterium. The virus infection debilitates the immune system, and the bacterium causes an acute infection that is often responsible for death. Pandemics are now usually associated with virus infections, whether these are COVID-19, swine flu, or AIDS. this was not always the case. Plague. The most infamous bacterial pandemic in the British Isles occurred in the summer of 1348. It is known as the Second Plague Pandemic. The Black Death, caused by Yersinia pestis, originated in Asia and was thought to be carried to the British Isles by black rats travelling on a ship that landed in the west of England. It soon spread during the next year to the rest of the British Isles and killed about a third of the whole population of the country and half the population of London over the next 2 years. The reasons for its rapid spread are easy to understand. Families were large and lived and slept in one room. Hygiene was poor, and biting parasitic insects were common. It is impossible to imagine what the loss of a third of the population would mean in current society, but its effects were devastating in the 14th century. Prior to the Black Death, the population had largely remained in their towns and villages, but by the start of the 1350s there were severe labour shortages, and the peasants started to travel to exploit this and demand higher wages. This led to inflation, and the Statute of Labourers was introduced in 1351, prohibiting the movement of labourers and fixing wages at their pre-Black Death levels. The restrictions that this imposed led eventually to the Peasants' Revolt of 1381. This demonstrates that even in the 14th century, the loss of such a huge proportion of the population led to the undermining of society. The second pandemic returned to the British Isles regularly until the middle of the 17th century, when improved living conditions and hygiene, as well as the implementation of measures to prevent spread by the pneumonic form, lessened the capacity of the population to become infected and the ability of the bacterium to spread. The modern, or third pandemic, again started in China in the mid-19th century. It was exported by ship from Hong Kong to Bombay and killed more than 12 million people in India and China. It spread across the world to all continents and was introduced into the United States through the port of San Francisco. By now, the causative bacillus had been isolated and the method of transmission by rat fleas discovered, enabling stringent controls to be introduced that prevented the carriage of rats on ships. In the United States, the last major outbreak was in the city of Los Angeles in the mid-1920s. The advent of antibiotics ensured that any cases could be rapidly treated, and the spread of the organism was quickly controlled. The pandemic dwindled, and now only a few cases annually from around 15 countries are reported. The residue of the pandemic remains in the wild rodent population of the Sierras in California, though this is rarely transmitted to humans. Cholera. A bacterium that is equally swift at killing is Vibrio cholerae, the causative bacterium for cholera. This waterborne bacterium has also been responsible for pandemics, 7 in the last 200 years, according to the World Health Organization. Because of the low speed of transport and the rapid onset of symptoms, before the mid-19th century, cholera outbreaks were largely contained in and around the country in which they emerged. The first pandemic originated in the Indian subcontinent, or China, in common with those pandemics that followed. Cholera was endemic in the region surrounding the Ganges, and pilgrims to the festivals carried the organism back to their own villages and towns. This had happened in previous outbreaks, but by the 1820s, British soldiers had carried it to areas far from the subcontinent, including Africa and the rest of Asia. The second pandemic spread more quickly during the 1830s, as communications had improved. Again starting in India, it spread to Europe, Russia, Canada, and the United States. It was responsible for a number of deaths in the British Isles up to the end of the 1840s. However, the cause of the infection was not understood until the third pandemic reached London in 1853, and John Snow identified that contamination of the water supply was responsible. Even so, this pandemic was responsible for more than 10,000 deaths in London. However, it was the last time that cholera seriously affected the United Kingdom. Further pandemics occurred during the 19th century, but better hygiene largely prevented cholera seriously affecting Europe, except for the fifth pandemic, causing a major outbreak in Hamburg in 1892, and some parts of Eastern Europe affected by the sixth pandemic in the early 20th century. We are still experiencing the final and seventh pandemic. It started in the 1960s, this time in Indonesia. The causative bacterium was not the classic strain, but a related strain called El Tor. It had originally been isolated from a cholera patient being treated in El Tor in Egypt in 1905. The strain spread from Indonesia to the subcontinent and North Africa. From North Africa it spread to Italy, though the number of cases was relatively few. This strain spread to South America, in particular Peru and northern Chile, and from there to the southern United States. El Tor is a milder pathogen than the classic strain, and its symptoms are less severe. However, the main controls of the current pandemic have been better hygiene, preventing infection in the first place, and much more effective treatments, reducing mortality. Leprosy and tuberculosis. Plague and cholera are infections of rapid onset and swift mortality. It is thus easy to follow their spread across the world. Two related bacteria are far slower in their transmission. They are Mycobacterium leprae and Mycobacterium tuberculosis, the causative bacteria for leprosy and tuberculosis. For this reason, they have been much more difficult to control. Leprosy and plague were considered to be the two major epidemics of the Middle Ages, and leprosy remained so until the 18th century. Certainly, leprosy was common in Europe, though it did not follow classic pandemic distribution. Indeed, in many areas, it was probably endemic. Leprosy is an infection of the skin and nerves. Although it is contagious, a person has to have long exposure before the bacterium can establish an infection. There has been a progressive decrease in the number of infections, partly due to better and more rapid diagnosis and subsequent antibiotic treatment, but also possibly to less crowded living conditions and an improved host immune status. India still has the majority of cases, mostly in poor communities, but the disease is found in other countries of the subcontinent, parts of Africa, and in Brazil. Currently, the proportion of cases in the world is now only 10% compared with the past, so this is a bacterial pandemic that is also declining. The same used to be true for tuberculosis, as it was for most of the major bacterial infections, but now the number of cases is increasing. Also slow-growing, Mycobacterium tuberculosis can spread more quickly, as it is usually airborne, and coughing is a common symptom. The universality of air travel is thought to promote the spread of tuberculosis, but there is no strong evidence for this. Probably the major cause of the resurgence of tuberculosis is the increase in infections by human immunodeficiency virus, HIV, which undermines the body's defences against tuberculosis so that it is a common accompanying infection. Tuberculosis is a disease particularly of the urban poor, not just in the developing world but also in the ghettos of industrialised countries, with inadequate access to healthcare being a further contributing factor. Infection can only occur from those suffering from active infection and is transmitted on droplets. The infective dose of Mycobacterium tuberculosis is as low as 10 bacterial cells, so any droplet in theory could initiate an infection. Prolonged contact increases the risk, as does the virulence of the strain and how well the environment is ventilated. The vast majority of those infected do not develop the disease, but it may remain latent. The risk of progression to active tuberculosis infection depends on immune status, due to either infection or previous history of transplant requiring immunosuppression, cancer, or other underlying medical conditions. Low body mass is also associated with active infection, which probably accounts for its increased transmission in deprived communities, and partly for these reasons, the epidemic has been difficult to control. Furthermore, a major risk factor is diabetes mellitus, and the number of these cases is currently increasing worldwide. The extent of the tuberculosis epidemic at the start of the 20th century was a major incentive to find drugs that could cure it. However, the White Death was beginning to decline in the United Kingdom. Living conditions improved, and at some point around 1935, the number of rooms in a family dwelling exceeded the number within the family. This had a considerable influence in reducing the spread of all types of infection, not just tuberculosis. It was, however, the discovery of streptomycin, one of the earliest antibiotics, that broke the tuberculosis epidemic cycle in the United Kingdom, and appropriate timely treatment can provide a cure. In many areas, poor medical supervision and insufficient dosing have resulted in a resurgence of antibiotic-resistant tuberculosis. Treatment of tuberculosis requires daily administration of antibiotics for as long as 6 months, almost impossible in some countries. There are very few options for infections caused by these bacteria. One method of control has been vaccination with the bacillus Calmette-Guérin, commonly known as BCG, an attenuated live tuberculosis strain from cattle. It does provide some protection for about 15 years, but largely in those countries where tuberculosis is on the decline. The efficacy of BCG is considerably lower in countries where the bacterium is still responsible for an epidemic. The extent of the epidemic has ensured that one-third of the world's population has been infected. Though most are asymptomatic, in some countries the proportion of the population with active infections is around 2%, and it is compounded by the fact that 20% of these strains are resistant to the main antibiotics. Until this situation is reversed, there is little prospect that the epidemic will dissipate. Sexually transmitted infections. Currently, the most feared sexually transmitted disease is caused by a virus, human immunodeficiency virus, HIV. Nearly 1% of the world's population is infected. In the United Kingdom, the figure is under 0.2%, but rises to 5% in sub-Saharan Africa. In contrast, it has been suggested that at the turn of the 20th century, 10% of the adult male population in the United Kingdom had syphilis. This bacterial epidemic, then untreatable with antibiotics, was as shocking as the HIV epidemic is today, and had an eventual mortality rate of up to 50%. The social taboos of the time led many men to have their early sexual experiences with prostitutes, who provided a reservoir for the epidemic. The bacterium, Treponema pallidum, is commonly believed to have come to Europe in the 15th century from the Americas, though there is some evidence that it was prevalent in ancient Greece and Rome. It spread rapidly during the Renaissance, facilitated by the migrations occurring at that time, and, because of its symptoms producing pustules like smallpox, soon earned its nickname of the pox. Syphilis was widely treated with mercury, but it was probably due to the promotion of condoms, particularly by the military in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, and the introduction of salvarsan in 1912, that the incidence began to decrease. The advent of antibiotics reduced the epidemic, so that by the end of the 20th century there were only sporadic cases in the developed world, though it is still prevalent outside Europe and North America. The two most common sexually transmitted bacterial infections are chlamydia and gonorrhea. Gonorrhea, caused by the bacterium Neisseria gonorrhoeae, has been documented in England since at least the 12th century, and has been presumptively diagnosed in men by a burning sensation while urinating. Women have a greater risk of becoming infected from infected men than men from infected women. As it is initially asymptomatic in many women, the infection can spread unnoticed, making it difficult to track. The work of the clinics that treat infected patients is not just the administration of antibiotics, but also tracing previous sexual partners. Through this extraordinarily difficult and sensitive task, many contacts can be treated who have shown no symptoms. The incidence of gonorrhea fell with the introduction of condoms, antibiotics, and more recently fears about infection with HIV. Early treatment of gonorrhea soon clears the infection, but if left, it can cause serious medical problems. Chlamydia is a more prevalent sexually transmitted disease. Like gonorrhea, most women show no symptoms when infected, and the bacterium can remain undetected for years. In both sexes, it can lead to inflammation in the genitals, but this often occurs long after the bacterium has been passed to other partners. The bacterium, Chlamydia trachomatis, only multiplies in human cells and can be difficult to detect. Indeed, it cannot be detected by culture, but rather by modern DNA techniques. The low detection rate ensures that chlamydia is a silent pandemic, and current assessments of the prevalence of infection are almost certainly underestimates. Bacterial toxins as weapons. In the Middle Ages, during the siege of a town, as the population was starving, contaminated meat or even feces were often catapulted over the wall in an attempt to weaken the besieged population by disease. There were even attempts to introduce plague into these towns. The problem with this early form of germ warfare is that the aggressors could not control the extent of the infections and were often infected themselves once the town had been taken. A bacterium was needed that could be contained and did not pose a threat to the army using it. Anthrax, caused by Bacillus anthracis, was a convenient choice. This spore-forming bacterium has a very high mortality rate, does not spread extensively from its target area, and does not spread from person to person. The bacillus was isolated by Robert Koch in 1876, and attempts were made to use it during the First World War, particularly against livestock and the horses of the cavalry on both sides. This was not very effective. So, during the Second World War, Grignard Island, off the west coast of Scotland, was bombed with a particularly virulent strain of anthrax bacilli in 1942. Sheep on that island soon succumbed to anthrax. The conclusions drawn were that an anthrax bomb would provide a potent weapon against German cities. However, it had not been possible to decontaminate the island, and it was concluded that bombed areas would be uninhabitable for years. In order to determine how long the strain would persist, sheep were introduced onto the island annually, and they always became infected. In 1986, attempts were made to decontaminate the island with formaldehyde, and much of the topsoil was removed. There have been no cases of anthrax since then. The failure to decontaminate Grignard Island meant that anthrax was not deployed during the Second World War. The threat of anthrax as a biological weapon has emerged periodically since then, when individuals have tried to send anthrax spores through the post, but these are largely unsuccessful, though 5 people were killed in the attacks of 2001. Other biologicals have been developed, not least the botulinum toxin by Iraq in 1991. Sufficient was produced to annihilate the population of the world by inhalation, but the associated problem of controlling the damage to the target could never be overcome. Furthermore, this toxin soon deteriorates in the presence of air. Most nations have now signed the Biological and Toxic Weapons Convention, banning the use and development of infective agents as weapons. The risk of these biological weapons of mass destruction is likely always to be present, but the prerequisite for containment may inhibit their use.